The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to this week's Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. On today's podcast, we're getting down and dirty with the business of web startups. We've got financier Simon Carmichael from Torch Partners answering your pitch questions, whether you're looking for angel, first round, or later investment. We'll also be talking about the latest on the accusations of price fixing and insider trading amongst angel investors in Silicon Valley. Oh my. And we'll hear from internet entrepreneur and investor Jason Calacanis, founder of Mahalo.com and co-founder of Weblogs Inc. Joining me to talk shop are Jemima Kish and Charles Arthur. Welcome.
Hello.
Hola, hola, hola.
Jemima, I'm going to come to you in a second, but yes. Charles, you have some exciting news today. You sat next to a next Kindle or a Next e-reader, didn't you?
It's a tablet which is being sold by Next, the clothing people. And people have been going, it's only £180.
That's
come
amazing.
On, it's
did,
less
did
than half the price of an iPad.
Did it used to be much better in the 90s?
Possibly. It couldn't have been worse in the 90s because I tried it out and it's an Android tablet. You turn it on. Rory Cuthan-Jones from the BBC was sort of trying. He said, try it out. See if you can get further than me.
He wasn't just trying it out, actually. He was showing it off, wasn't he?
Well, he was sort of showing it off. But anyway, he said, okay. So, and it shows Android. And he said, okay, great. What should we do? I said, okay, well, let's have a look at the email. And I said, file manager? Certainly. And the file manager came up and said, no, I don't want the file manager. And he looked around for a back button. There wasn't a back button. So I pressed the home button. Pressed the home button and says, okay, we're back at the screen that you weren't at before.
Oh, no. It sounds like a user interface fail, Charles.
Labyrinthine UI.
It is evil and awful. And I have to say that based on that experience and also other experiences that I've seen from people around the web, you know, where they actually bought the thing and reviewed it, it is not worth £180.
Jemima, do you think people will care? I mean, it's going to be flashy, it's going to be the future, it's going to be from Next.
Yeah, from Next. I wouldn't. That's like buying a car from Clinton Cards
from
or something.
Tesco or other shopping experiences are available.
No.
Well, also joining us is entrepreneur Sam Barnett from Struck.com. Welcome. You will be sharing your on-the-ground experience of being a startup in the UK.
I guess I share a different view. Being somebody that has been close and not being a highly profitable company and not taking funding to, you know, most people coming in and saying, you need to take that money, you need to take that funding. In fact, you know, startups should, you know, learn how to make money, learn how to build a business.
Well, hold that thought because we'll be coming back to that later on in the podcast. We'll be looking, in addition to all of this, we'll be looking at some of the hardware stories that are hitting the headlines this week, including the apparent monopoly that BT have over broadband in the UK and the troubles that are hitting Android. It is a jam-packed show. Oh, and I forgot to mention, we're going to deconstruct the latest information from Twitter.com, wherein Ev Williams is standing down. So, keep listening to Tech Weekly. First, here's this week's news. British Telecom announced this week that it will seek to set up high-speed internet access broadband exchanges in the five areas that appear to have the greatest interest. Now, this commercial proposition will be determined with an online survey on the communication provider's website, a campaign that they're calling Race to Infinity, which will ask for local communities to record their interests. The five communities that demonstrate the most interest will have their fiber optic systems by 2012. It's part of a pledge by BT to get 70% of the UK connected to high-speed fiber-optic broadband by 2015. But Charles, this story isn't as altruistic as it seems. BT isn't the only internet provider in the UK, after all. What does this mean for the competition?
Well, the principal competition is Virgin Media, which actually passes more homes with its cable offering. Passes about 12.7 million homes and is looking to expand that next year. BT passes rather fewer, but it's looking to pass an extra 6 million. What BT is trying to do here is rather like what happened with the first broadband rollout, the copper rollout back in the sort of early 2000s sort of period, when it would say to various places which didn't have broadband enabled exchanges, hey, if everyone registers and indicates that they're really interested in it, then we'll enable your broadband exchange. But what happened was that because BT was moving rather slowly there, a lot of other would-be providers started saying, don't wait for BT. We'll do your exchange and we'll start offering services to you. BT got very worried about this and began to simply say, oh, tear up this thing. We're just going to enable all the exchanges as fast as we can. And so BT emerged as a dominant provider of internet services in the UK. It's one of the four biggest ISPs, so that's BT Retail. This is about getting fibre optic. Now, with fibre optic, there's a very strange situation which prevails, which is that BT has a lot of fibre optic cable. If you lay fibre optic cable and start using it, then you get charged business rates on it, as if it was premises. There's an organisation called the Valuations Office Agency, which determines how much you should pay. And if you're a small company starting up and you lay, say, a kilometre of fibre optic cable, you could be paying up to £2,000 per kilometre in business rates on that cable, depending how many of the cables you're actually, you know, the fibre optic fibres you're using. BT pays something around about £20 per kilometre. So for BT to expand its fibre optic network is comparatively cheap in terms of the rates it has to pay compared to a small startup. That means that there's no great incentive for the small startups to do it, and that if BT can start to push its fibre out in this way and get and win the PR battle as much as anything, then it's going to dominate the provision of fibre optic in the UK. But equally, it's not going to have to push it on as fast as perhaps it would if there was a more equal playing field in the way that these are taxed.
And this is to do really with the abandonment of the tax pledge made by the Tories.
Well, the Tory party in their manifesto said that they would review the way that the VOA, the Valuations Office Agency, does this rating, because, you know, there have been a number of court cases over it, and it just doesn't make any sense. The VOA says, well, BT's got a pretty big network, 147 million, that'll cover it. And then for people got smaller networks, they say, yeah, okay, well, we can see this goes from here to here, so you're going to have to pay this much. And proportionally, it's huge. And actually, there's a whole issue. Why would you tax fiber optic cable in the way that you would a business premises?
So how will the competition respond?
It's a rather difficult one to do. The Tories parked this manifesto pledge. Ed Vasey, who's the communications minister, said that they weren't actually going to get the VOA to review it. What I'm hearing privately is that this is because the Department of Communities and Local Government, where Eric Pickles recently said that they're not going to try to re-rate homes to look at how their council tax bandings goes, even though they said they would do it when they were in opposition. It's because everyone feels the whole structure of how you charge business rates and council tax rates is so creaky that if you poke one bit of it, the whole thing could fall down. So it seems they're a bit scared of it. But it has to be said, it's a really bonkers tax, and it's completely retrograde. Really, what they should do is tax copper, which would then be an incentive for people to install fibre optic.
Well, next up, Microsoft is getting ready to launch its new Windows Mobile 7 phone by suing its rivals for patent infringement. On the 1st of October, they subpoenaed Motorola, which uses Google's Android operating system on its handsets, for using technology that belonged to an expired patent. The tech in question is the system's ability to sync mail, calendars, and contacts, and to let apps know when signal or battery power is low. Now, the patents in question were leased from Microsoft between 2003 and 2007, but the license wasn't renewed thereafter. And Charles, this isn't the first time that Google's mobile operating system has come under fire. Earlier this year, Oracle sued for Android infringements associated with its Java programming language. What's going on? Why is Android being attacked?
Because it's selling a lot of handsets, I think, partly. And because the mobile industry, especially the smartphone industry, is expanding so quickly that people figure that patents and lawsuits is one great way to hold their rivals back. On the technology blog on Tuesday, I put up a diagram which shows who's suing who in the mobile industry. And it looks like an explosion in a spear factory. I mean, it's just incredible. Actually, the most litigious company turns out to be Nokia, which is suing six different people.
Well, that's inversely proportionate to how buggered it is, if I can use that expression.
The language on it.
And it's interesting because handset makers like HTC and Samsung and Motorola are all on the receiving end of these patents. And it's quite indicative that Apple is being sued by Nokia, and it's suing Nokia back, and it's suing HTC. It all just goes back and forth. It's a hell of a thing. Clearly, the reason why they're attacking Android is because they want to hold things back. And Steve Ballmer did an interview with the Wall Street Journal Europe earlier this week, in which he said it might not have a license, but it's got a patent license. In effect, he's saying there's a cost to running Android, and it's the cost of getting sued. Google isn't being sued by anyone apart from Oracle so far, because Oracle, which now owns Sun, which is the progenitor of Java, says that the way that Android works, in effect, uses Java in a way that's not licensed. So that's a sort of Uber lawsuit, and if that was to come through, then that could that could mean that Android isn't free at all. That's a real potential home buster there.
And it's a lot about the perception to shareholders, though, isn't it? Because in the absence of any overwhelmingly successful mobile device, they've got to be seen to be acting in that area in some way. And so they need to be seen to be looking tough by their shareholders, and that's why they like to do lawsuits, isn't it?
Well, it is, and certainly it's a good way of slowing down companies which otherwise might want to do things. So it's interesting that, for example, there are no such lawsuits against companies that that Microsoft's working closely with on Windows Phone 7.
So would you say that that this high profile case is Microsoft's move to attempt to destabilize the competition, or just to get a bit of publicity?
Oh, it's not for publicity. There's always money. There's always handsets to be made and money to be made out of it.
What effect do you think that all of this litigiousness is, if you can say that word, is going to have on the mobile industry?
I don't think for the users it's actually going to have that big an effect. By the time it reaches you, the consumer, all the costs of these sorts of licensing and patent issues have been swallowed up in all sorts of other costs. But it does have an effect on who remain the major players and who actually directs the direction that the whole mobile industry goes.
Finally, Ev Williams, co-founder and CEO of Twitter, has announced that he will be stepping down to be replaced by the company's COO, Dick Costolo. Jemima, what do we know about this story?
Well, he's not stepping down. He's stepping into more of a product development role, which I think is what he really loves doing. And Dick Costolo, who is very well respected and very well liked in the industry, is going to step up and do the chief executive stuff. I'm not sure Ev really, really loved doing that. He did the speaking in public, and he did the giving interviews when he had to. But I think he likes being quite hands-on. I don't think there's any hidden agenda there.
Charles, what will @DickC be bringing to the table?
Well, a lot more followers is what he tweeted this morning. He said, so that's how we get more followers, being announced as a CEO. He was the guy who set up Feedburner, which then got bought by Google, and he worked inside Google's ad site for quite a while. And what he really brings, I think, is going to be much more of a focus on how do you generate the revenues, how do you get the advertisers on board, how do you make sure that you have a strategy in place which is about growth, which is about profit, and which is not just being a startup, but which is actually being a company which is either going to be profitable in its own right and in private hands, or else perhaps is going to go for a flotation and a long-term future like that.
Sam, I'm going to bring you in here because we haven't heard from you yet in this podcast, and this really is your area. This seems to be a common problem in Silicon Valley, ideas, people being thrust into these chief executive roles where ultimately, as Jemima and Charles are suggesting, they want to get their hands dirty. And so what do you do about this?
Sometimes the founders do make good CEOs despite their lack of experience in cases where they understand product market fit, which is ultimately the most important thing for a company. Then it becomes a question of how do you scale and grow the company most successfully if you're not the person to take product market fit forward, and as Charles said, revenue, profit, and transform that business into a business from a startup to a business, then consider it time to step aside. And that's the right thing for a business. Ultimately, you have to put what is the purpose of the business at the forefront, not pride, ego.
Well, and I was going to say that it takes quite a lot of maturity, doesn't it, to recognize that, as opposed to, sticking your ground and saying, I'm going to drive this ship, seeing that ultimately you need to treat this as a business.
Correct. But I guess if you look at some of the big cases, you look at Bill Gates, you look at Oracle, you look at numerous companies that have grown with their founders to CEO, and they've scaled that globally as a proposition. But you're right, it did take a lot of maturity to say, this is what I'm best at, these are what my skills are. This is how the company can benefit most.
Well, more information on these stories is at guardian.co.uk/technology. If Jason Calacanis was 10 years younger, the 40-year-old East Coast-based web entrepreneur and businessman could be called an internet enfant terrible. Not one to pull his punches, he recently sat down with Jemima and threw a few carefully directed barbs at members of the web tech community, whom he accuses are freezing him out of key events. Jemima, tell us more.
Well, when I managed to get a word in edgeways, which is quite hard with Jason Calacanis, he is known for talking somewhat, he basically has a bit of a gripe with Mike Arrington, who he set up an event with, the TechCrunch 20, which became 40, which became 50. And then Mike just decided not to talk to him for a bit. Took him out to dinner and then said he was pushing him out, basically. This is Jason's side of the story.
Can you give us a little bit of background on Mr. Calacanis?
Yep. He started Silicon Alley Reporter in New York in 96, just as the internet was really taking off, which was very prescient. Did that for a few years and eventually folded, but he had the foresight to co-found Weblogs Inc., which he sold to AOL for gazillions. So he's been around forever. He reinvested a lot of his money in startups. His latest thing is Mahalo.com, which is a kind of Q&A meets Wikipedia type thing. It started as social search, but it's kind of evolving into something else, and they're producing a lot of their own content now. So he's more on the content side of startups, which is interesting.
So he is a man to listen to. And how did you, what happened when you met with him?
Yes, so I started by asking him what he thought about his now nemesis, Mike Arrington, selling TechCrunch to AOL.
I'm very happy for the writers of TechCrunch. They worked very hard, but obviously I'm not totally excited about the fact that I helped build the brand doing TechCrunch 50 with Mike and was kicked out of the company and then basically created a lot of value and didn't get anything for it. But, that story is still underway, and I think there might be some resolution that occurs. But even if there isn't, it's my job as an entrepreneur after getting kicked out of there and basically screwed to get back off the ground and dust myself off and engage the fight, which is what I plan on doing.
And you're doing that by which means?
I am going to launch a competitor to TechCrunch called Launch, which will be a conference similar to TechCrunch 50 in that companies will launch at it or disrupt. But in addition to the event, I will also be doing an editorial property that will be of depth and substance, not a blog, probably manifesting itself in email. I have my email newsletter, jasonnation.com, which has 22,000 people on it. And this past Friday, I did a profile of a company, and we spent 2,000 words talking about a company here in the UK, Zumbu, which does sort of travel. And we spent a couple days on that, and it seems like the world needs a competitor to TechCrunch. And now that Mike has screwed me and kicked me out, he has created one. I would not have created this if he had not screwed me, but now I think this is the best way for me to combat the fact that he essentially took $3 or $4 million from me or whatever my portion of that sale would have been. Not that it's about money. It's more about what's fair, you know. So since he's stolen from me, now I will pay him back by creating a competitor. And
so is there going to be a lawsuit?
To be determined, to be honest. We'll see. I am talking to my lawyers about it, and you know, perhaps there'll be some sort of a settlement. That's what I would hope, that I would get something. Maybe he can pay for London's college. That's my daughter. You know, and I'm reasonable about it. Like I said, it's not about money. It's about fairness. I helped build that brand. And right before he sold it to AOL, he kicked me out.
And it's a bit ironic that the creator of Weblogs Inc., who then sold that company to AOL in 2005, now thinks that perhaps blogs have had their day. But you're going back to editorial.
Yeah, I think blogs, when we started them, there was a much smaller number of people blogging who had a much greater depth of knowledge, let's say, like a Peter Rojas doing Engadget and before that Gizmodo. So when he was to blog, you know, about a new phone, he could write 100 words and it'd be incredibly insightful because he'd been covering consumer electronics for a decade. Now you have people who really maybe have a year or two experience writing some quick post on this new phone, and they don't actually do any research. They don't have any knowledge base. There's no wisdom there, you know, and I think that's what's happened with blogging. Too many people blogging the same story, none of them doing any primary research, none of them having any wisdom or knowledge base to work off of, which is why blogs feel so vapid and like whipped cream today. It's that there's too many of them covering the same space. And the bloggers all have the same purpose. They want to get their story up on TechMeme as quick as possible so they can get 500 people from TechMeme to come to their site or whatever it winds up being. It's minuscule. That's the wrong race to be in. Really, the right race to be in is high-quality editorial. Now, it just feels like a lot of these blogs are saying nothing. And to be honest, the people who are the true players in the industry, the people who are, you know, really making decisions, et cetera, they're not reading blogs. they're just, there's no substance there. They read it and go, wow, that's like 40% of what's actually going on, or 60% on a good day, or 35. So I think true depth and substance, giving journalists and bloggers enough time to create true depth and substance is going to be the future. And I'm lucky enough that I think the way I'm going to fund this company, I'll be able to do that. Maybe have journalists filing 50 times a year, once a week, as opposed to 5 times a day.
You also support a lot of startups. You're going to be writing about startups. So give us some strong tips for interesting companies to look out for.
Obviously, cloud computing is still something that hasn't hit the masses in a big way. Social networking is still in its early days. There are other social networks being built and integrated. So Reportive is something I've invested in, which is a plugin for Gmail that essentially takes all the social networks a person belongs in and puts their profile, a little mini profile, along the right-hand side of your Gmail. So basically this glue between social networks and leveraging the data in them to make interactions, you know, work a little bit better. It's more than dating or sharing photos. There's something else that could be done with the social graph. I think that's really phenomenally interesting.
And you're here for Open Angel Forum in London on Wednesday night. Can anyone just come along to this, or is it just special people?
Yes, it's very exclusive, but not in a pretentious way. It's actually done so in order to close transactions. It turns out that the people who are presenting at it, the 6 startup companies, are going to be presenting how much money they're raising and at what valuation. Pretty confidential information. And they're going to be showing their exact business plan and how they plan on becoming a big company. It's very confidential information. And so that sort of exclusivity or focus, I would call it, has resulted in about a third of the companies receiving angel investments. And the companies we're getting are people who are off the grid, which I find particularly exciting.
Also in this week's program is Simon Carmichael, head of private placements and venture sell sides, and director at Torch Partners, who specialized in helping more established tech companies make that next big funding round. Jemima, you recently spoke with him, and you asked him about AngelGate.
Well, Simon has a great overview of the industry. He's very experienced. He recently helped Huddle with their investment and Borrow.com, amongst others. We asked you to send your questions in, and we put those to Simon. But we started by talking about the AngelGate affair, where angels in Silicon Valley had been accused of collusion. And I started by asking him about the difference between the UK and US investment scenes.
I think the structure of the investing environment is quite different on the West Coast than it is here in Europe. And it has been the rise of this group of super angels who are, I think of as almost semi-institutionalized now, and they're deploying, you know, upwards of $1 million in companies. And really, if you're at that level in Europe, you're in the realms of the good Series A investors here rather than the super angels. So they have that slightly different layer of, as we call them, super angels that we don't really have here. My experience has been that in almost every venture capital deal that gets, if it's good enough to get done in Europe, it will have been a competitive deal. It'll have a couple of offers on the table, and that in general, the VCs are very competitive on price. Now, I can't speak about the super angels because I've never done a transaction with any of them, but I think it's unlikely that what was going on is what was postulated.
Can you give us some examples of big deals that you've been involved in and quite why those companies managed to be successful, how they managed to get that deal?
I think I would disaggregate two things. Are they successful raising capital? Yes. Have they been successful as companies? Yes. The second question is often more important because the capital follows successful companies to some extent. And what is often differentiated them as successful companies has been that they have an economic model that fundamentally works. They have a product that people want, and they've nailed the business model.
So you talk to a lot of entrepreneurs and obviously a lot of colleagues in private equity and venture capital businesses. What are the common mistakes that entrepreneurs make when they're trying to raise, say, their second round of funding?
Entrepreneurs often overestimate the amount of time that providers of finance give to any one deal, and they therefore don't necessarily explain things as succinctly as possible. So give them a simple, big hit. Don't kind of over-elaborate your answer much like I'm doing here. Give a clear, succinct answer as to what problem it is you're solving. why people are going to pay for it, what your business model is, who your competitors are. You may elaborate later, but give them the answer.
And to what extent does the success of a pitch come down to the confidence and the attitude of the entrepreneur?
I think that is a very important part of it. But entrepreneurs who are confident are often confident because they know their stuff, they know their markets, they know all the metrics of their business. You know, what creates confidence is being on top of your game.
Where would you advise that entrepreneurs go to learn about the industry? Because it's quite complex, there's a lot of jargon, and there's a lot of pretty basic things you'd need to know about to avoid making basic mistakes.
I think you should talk to other entrepreneurs who've successfully raised capital. I am a big believer in the kind of ecosystem of networking that's arisen in London, but it's also fair to say that you shouldn't equate standing at drinks parties with actually building real businesses, and that is the most important thing. Talking to entrepreneurs, lawyers who advise on these types of transactions, bankers who advise on it, and then, you know, reading the industry press.
And are there any types of businesses that are particularly popular among entrepreneurs at the moment? Any that are seen as perhaps a slightly safer bet? Because I'm guessing that music, for example, wouldn't be seen as that much of a safe bet among investors.
Well, interestingly, there has been, in the music world, there has been a lot of activity around the ticketing of that, and in particular the live music side of things. And I think there's a perception that the value of recorded music is going lower. But the live experience will always have some value to it. But on your broader question, the venture capital community in particular is driven by big mega trends in technology. I would say the kind of mega trend I would point to is the migration to utility or cloud computing.
There's a question from lovely bard, Sophia Burnett, who says, I'm starting up my business in France. Is that a potential put-off for UK or US-based VCs?
I don't believe that you should start a business that needs venture capital. You should start a business that makes economic sense and can grow up without additional capital. So point number one. Point number two, there are plenty of good local VCs in Paris and probably in other parts of France, so I only know the Parisian ones. That should not put them off. What I would say is that venture capitalists, because they do like to keep an eye on their investments, do tend to invest quite locally. So, look, is a West Coast VC likely to invest in a French company? It is absolutely possible and it has definitely happened. But at the same time, the bar is higher.
This is from Better Bio on Twitter, who says, what's your investor take on the best startup models for web social ventures? Should they be non-profit, for-profit, B Corp partnerships?
Well, I can only answer the for-profit side of that equation, because non-profit, none of the investors that I know are going to invest in something that doesn't fundamentally have some way of making money. On the for-profit side, I see business models ranging from the kind of classic freemium, the kind of traffic slash media model, which I think is seems to be less in favor for sure. I also see things migrating towards transaction-driven models as well.
If this was Radio 4 today, we'd be asking you for your racing tips now. But
you've got the wrong torch partner for that, I'm afraid.
Oh, well. So we'll have to ask you for your tips on interesting UK companies instead. Yeah. Who's good to watch?
I'm broadly very optimistic about the environment. I keep seeing more and more interesting companies and entrepreneurs who've been through it a couple of times and are really starting to crack the economics of their business models. I would look at some of the interesting consumer finance models coming up. Wonga is an obviously interesting company, as is Borrow, as is people like Money Dashboard. I would also look at some of the hardcore IP companies that are really producing astonishing technology. All these things, I think, bode very well.
Well, we've heard the financial advisor's point of view, but what about the view of the startup scene in the UK from the ground? Now, Sam, you're CEO of Struck.com, a behavioral retargeting advertising company, which I will ask you about in a little while, that went from dire straits to a multi-million pound business. Now, I know you didn't take investment, but, you know, what was the process that you went through from the beginning of your idea to where you now feel that you are a successful company?
When I started in 2008, the financial crisis had rolled into town. The advertising market almost kind of shut down. And I was a 24-year-old kid who knocked on the doors of these big ad agencies telling them I was going to change online advertising. They all subsequently laughed me away, and I went back to the drawing board to find out, okay, if the product they were trying to develop won't be taken up by the mass market, how can we get a market to test our product so that we know it works, so they have proof of concept so we can actually scale it? And so there was no money for us. We didn't get an overdraft, a loan. So what we learned to do was run a company very lean, very aggressively, and to find product market fit, which means how can we get customers to open their wallets to buy a product from us? And so we used gambling as a test market. We built technology. Some of it stuck and we kept it. Some of it bombed and we binned it. And we just tried and tested. So at the same time, surviving off, you know, cash flow that was relatively thin. And we ran very close to the wire. In 2008, I was trading office furniture for an internet connection. And then 2009 came and we got our first main advertiser. And it had a kind of viral effect. The snowball effect was we couldn't keep up with demand.
How much do you would you say that you need to really develop a final product before you go for funding or before you go and try and land those deals?
Well, I guess before I started in 2008, I would have said, get funding so you've got enough time for R&D and all that other stuff. Truth is, find out what people are going to open their wallets for and find out quick. And so you find out the quickest when you don't have money. Our ability to hold on to cash and be so lean with it was exceptional. Now, I guess that what that taught us was we now know how to continue to build without funding because we understand exactly how to use capital as efficiently as possible.
Sam, I'm quite interested in, I mean, obviously it's really important to have a clear business model and to make money and to have the flexibility to change your business so that you make money eventually. But it's also really important to play, isn't it? And to allow yourself time to come up with the ideas. Because if you don't have creativity and flexibility built into your business, you have nothing to build with, do you?
We've got to a point where we grew so quickly that we lost that. This is an open question. How do we get back to spending time to creatively think about how to continue to iterate the business so we can continue to not just grow in our existing market, but to take on new marketing channels, take on new territories, and disrupt those markets in a big way?
Jemima, what do you think is the most difficult part of the process for most startups?
There are different challenges for different startups, I think. I think certainly for most very early stage companies, access to expertise, whether it's mentoring or the VC community, is very difficult.
Is this the UK VC scene just global?
Well, probably both, but yes, particularly the UK, I think, because they seem quite hidden. And that's something that Calacanis brought up, actually, which was that it's so established over there. People were getting into paying for their companies to be put in front of an audience with investors, which is a bit sad. I think there's a particular skill set as well and advice on how to refine your business proposal and make it really clear and develop your pitching skills and develop growth. All of those things are really important. And ultimately, I suppose the most important skills are flexibility, which is what Loic Lemur, the founder of Seismic, told me this week, that he recognised Seismic Video wasn't working, and so they switched to become a completely different product, which is a social media aggregator. You have to have a very clear vision of where you want to go with your business and the confidence to change it, and you have to work bloody hard.
Sam?
I think it's interesting about the point about advice. When I started out, I put an ad on TechCrunch for a mentor. I got 5 people back. 4 people were essentially, I'll say, scam artists trying to sell me stuff as an entrepreneur, how they'd raise me money and they charge me. And there's a lot of that going on in the UK right now. The 5th person turned out to be an absolute gem of a diamond, a guy called Jay Bregman, who founded eCoria. But I think that's a huge danger UK entrepreneurs face. They're like rabbits in the lights, and lots of people are trying to take advantage of them.
Charles, where do you think that in general people in the business, people get the business side wrong?
Oh, there are so many ways to get it wrong when you're running a business. I mean, Jack Cramer, who was a great tennis player in his time, he went professional, you know, they did professional, and he was talking to someone after he'd sort of given up his amateur days, talking about how he's going to be a professional, and the guy said to him, you know, Jack, most people don't get smart until they've gone bust twice. And, you know, that's generally the case, actually, is that a lot of people don't really get their business smarts until they've been through 2 business failures, because that's what it takes to sort of recognize what things you get wrong, how to know when the business is actually dying on its feet. And actually, you know, it has to be said, companies that get through the first time and live and grow are in many ways the exception. Don't forget, most businesses, you know, don't get past, you know, the first couple of years.
I think the US is better at accepting failure as an essential learning part of business culture. I think there's a bit more of a stigma to it in the UK.
But the thing that's absolutely true for entrepreneurs is that it's about cash. If you've not got the cash, then you're out of business.
Finally, Sam, what advice would you give to people just starting out?
Learn how to sell. Understand how people will buy something from you. Crucial, because you need to sell something to get people to understand whether they'll buy it or not. The key to understanding product market fit. And then learn to ditch things that don't work quickly. Learn to iterate even quicker.
Well, find out what Sam's done at Struck.com and share your own startup advice on the blog guardian.co.uk/techweekly or guardian.co.uk/PDA. That's it for this week. Thanks to our studio guests, Sam Barnett, Jemima Kish, and Charles Arthur. Also, thanks to Simon Carmichael for his time and Jason Calacanis for his views. Find out more about the podcast and the team, comment on anything we've talked about in today's show, and give us some general love on guardian.co.uk/techweekly. We're here every Tuesday. The producer this week was Scott Colley, and I'm Alex Krotowski. See you next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.